Good evening. It's been a while since, I'm going to stand back here so I'll stand in the sun. It's been a while since I've been able to teach in this class. I've told several people over the last few weeks I don't feel like I've seen any of you because this was my time to get to spend with you all, with this crew, and be able to socialize a little bit. And usually on Sundays and Wednesdays we're running around like crazy taking care of things and I don't get much time to be with you. So I'm glad to get to fill in here for a week until Bill gets back. Keep he and Kay in your prayers as they're in Mountain Home. I believe this is their last evening there. Haven't heard from them. We're assuming everything's going well. So they're have a meeting, I believe, in Sunday night through tonight. He's finishing up their summer series for them there at Mountain Home. So keep them in your prayers for the week and then for their travels home. I don't know exactly what day they're coming home. They thought about staying for a couple of days, but we'll see. If I could have, Eddie, can I ask you a favor from you? Could you hand a few things out? And John, could I have you to do this side? I'll let you do this side. I have handouts tonight. This is just not really specifically for our lesson tonight, but something that I like to keep on hand close because it's a good reference for me. So while we're handing those out, what we'll do is I believe I'm going to follow Bill's format. And we'll ask ourselves about some of our Bible readings this week, correct? Is that what the normal plan is, to ask ourselves of those readings? We read from the book of Psalms this week, Psalms 20 through 26. We read 1 Samuel chapters 8 through 15. We read Jeremiah chapter 52 and then on to the book of Lamentations, all five chapters of that book. We read the first portion of the chapter of Habakkuk, and then the second through fifth chapter of 1 Peter, and then down into the second chapter of 2 Peter. And so, if I'm not mistaken, Bill's I don't have this exact wording, but tell us, if you don't mind, what stood out to you this reading? What may have touched you as you read, or what has caused you to think, or something for you to think about for this that you'd like to share? Yes, Clay.
Saul was told to kill and eliminate the Amalekites.
That's right.
And he decided not to do all of them. He brought the king back and the animals. And the part that I feel was most impressive was when Samuel said, "It's better to obey than to sacrifice."
That's correct. 1 Samuel chapter 15, if you didn't hear, is the story of King Saul, even with good motives, even with good intentions in his mind. He was told to go in and destroy the Amalekites and destroy the king and all the people and all the livestock and everything that went with it. And he went in and he did most of it. And did most of what he was told to do, and then the people decided that it would be best to keep back the best things. And it was interesting that it's not even for themselves. They kept it back intending to deliver it to the Lord. They said, "We thought we'd keep the best so that we could." You need some more? I made 70. I hope that, and is that enough? If you didn't get one, see me after class and we'll make sure you do, that we can make plenty more copies if we need to. King Saul decided that it was going to be best to keep some back, even to give to the Lord. And, of course, we find out from Samuel that's actually not the best. Even with good intentions, deciding what it is that the Lord does and doesn't want is not up to us. It's not up to man, and it wasn't up to Saul. And sometimes we can fall into, an old friend of mine used to say, that when we begin to make decisions or speak for God or on behalf of God, where he's not really spoken, we begin to tread on very thin ice. And Saul's a good example of that. Good. 1 Samuel chapter 15 is a good one. Did anybody, I'll have to ask, did anybody catch I know it's not technically from this week's reading, but 1 Samuel chapter 7, did anybody catch the phrase that we just sung about in the invitation song? Did anybody catch that one? We sing in the second verse, "Here I raise my Ebenezer." Did anybody see it in 1 Samuel chapter 7? That's where that comes from. All right, we got some good close readers. That passage is taken directly from 1 Samuel chapter 7, where they are going across the, going in, and Samuel takes a stone and they set it up and they call its name Ebenezer, because that means hither by thy help I've come, or thus far the Lord has helped us. So that's why we sing that song, or the phrase from that song. Anybody else? What is it that struck you this week from your readings? Yes, ma'am.
Well, I like to sing. I had written down Psalms 21:13, and then he's talking about singing a psalm, and then I went to Ephesians 5:19, and the New Testament word tells us to sing.
To sing psalms from Psalm 21 and verse. From Psalm 21 and verse 13, speaks of singing the Psalms, as well as does Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 19. One day when I was in college, we did an interesting thing, and maybe y'all have had a similar experience. We forgot our songbooks one night. We went to a folks' house to sing, and we forgot our songbooks. And so we were trying to think of songs that we would know, and the suggestion was, why don't we just use our Bibles and we'll sing? And so what we did was we found passages in the Bible that were songs, and we used our Bibles as the songbooks, and many of them come from the Psalms, Psalm 90 and Psalm 23, and a lot of those Psalms that are taken word for word. One of them was in, I believe, Psalm 20, I believe, or I think Psalm 20, yeah, Psalm 20 is one of those songs that is a good one that we have sung before. So, lots of those. Thank you very much, Gail. Anybody else that have one they want to share from the week? Yes, ma'am.
I love verse 2 Peter, and there's so many verses that really pop out, but the one that really stood out to me is 1 Peter 4:8, above all, love each other.
Above all, love each other. 1 Peter 4:8, deeply. I think mine, I'm going to reference mine. Mine has a different wording, I believe. Could be wrong, but I think, no, yeah, mine is the same way. Above all things, have fervent love for one another, or love each other, from 1 Peter chapter 4, and starts in verse 7 and continues down, all concerning about the relationships, and it gives a list of things that the way that you and I ought to treat each other, things that you and I should share in our relationships. And of course, the first one is, above everything, have fervent love for each other. And you're said, love deeply. I like that. Love deeply each other. Good, good, good. Anyone else have one they want to share? Yes, Mr. Dennis?
I like 1 Peter 3:12, for the eyes of the Lord are over the righteous, and his ears are open unto their prayers.
For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayers.
The face of the Lord is against them that do evil.
Just sometimes the simplest of promises, right, can just take comfort. Tell us.
My wife and I today were talking about something you don't hear anymore. I said, what are we going on tonight? She said, prayer meeting. And I can remember when we always referred to this as prayer meeting.
Uh-huh.
This verse seems to be very appropriate, that when we pray, whether congregated like this or in the privacy, the Lord will hear our prayer.
Very interesting. Prayer meetings had been a thing of the past by the time I came around. I've never been, unless we had a special prayer service. Wednesday was always Wednesday Bible class. It wasn't a prayer meeting time when I was growing up. But I wasn't intending to do that. Anyone else have something that they want to share from their readings? All right. Oh, yes, Eddie, go ahead. They have not.
Okay. Well, of course, and he's talking about psalms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, part of a psalm comes from Lamentations chapter 3. You know, great is thy faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I will not look at him. Basically, the idea is what he's talking about, even though Jeremiah talks about how terrible the aftermath of the destruction of Jerusalem was by Babylonians. I'm already taking on your...
No, I'm letting you go.
Anyway, the point is here is that there is always hope, because God never lets us go, even no matter what type of situation we face ourselves in. And this was a really terrible situation. There's always hope. No matter what happens, we shouldn't despair and give up.
Well, I'm glad someone thinks like me. I'm not alone. Lamentations chapter 3 is the passage that we're going to spend our time in tonight, which is, Of course, we had just sung the song at the beginning of service. That was no accident either. This is where we're going to be, from Lamentations chapter 3 tonight. There were so many passages to choose from this week. All of the Psalms, of course, in that little section is Psalm 22, 23, and 24, all of which are messianic psalms, looking forward to the great shepherd and the great Savior and the great sovereign Lord that our Savior is. All of those wonderful things we could do. We are going to spend time tonight, though, in all the choices that we could have. We're going to spend time in the book of Lamentations. Lamentations is not a very fun book to read, is it? Not because it's hard to understand, or not because, you know, sometimes when we like reading in the book of Leviticus, it's laborious and it's a challenge because you don't understand what's going on, and sometimes, and it's just the language is sometimes over our heads, and it's just hard to read things repetitive like Leviticus or Numbers sometimes is. The book of Lamentations is difficult to read because it's so painful, and it's so just heartbreaking to read some of the things that Jeremiah writes about going through. And of course, Jeremiah is the author. And of course, we finished this week, and I believe Bill had two or three of his Wednesday Peak of the Weeks from the book of Jeremiah, and I hope that y'all are familiar with that. We're going to take some time now, and before we go any further, I gave you that sheet. A friend of mine, when I was in preaching school, sat down at his computer and made this up. His name is Aaron Birch. I wrote his name in the bottom left-hand corner there, so you've got my handwriting. It'll be worth lots of money one day. Don't forget that. Aaron Birch is a friend of mine and made this little chart up. And what it is a timeline. And it's just very simply it starts at the top. And if you notice on the right side, those are your dates, right? It begins way back about 1000 BC and it goes all the way down to just about the time when the Lord is born. And so that's your standard on the right side. And then he's got different things all the way interspersed through there. Some of the big long columns down in the middle, he writes the names of the prophets. It's sort of, sometimes people don't realize when we're studying the Bible, when you start from Genesis and read on through, you get to Malachi and you think that Malachi is so much later than everybody else, or you think that sometimes Hosea, because it's way near the end, that must have been, you know, near the end of things. But actually, Hosea was, you know, very early in you know, the early 700s BC, which is sort of, you can take the prophets, if you didn't know, you can take all of the prophets and you can pick them up and you can drop them in the middle of all the historical books, because all of those prophets have their place in the middle of somewhere between 1 Samuel and, you know, say the book of Ruth, somewhere around in there, the book of Esther and Ezra and Nehemiah. All of those prophets fit into that time frame somewhere. And this little chart sort of helps me to be able to wrap my head around where those prophets fit in. He writes on either side the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah. And so he lists all of the kings that reigned and when they reigned and how long they reigned. Tells them which, and he sort of puts them in the dates, and he gives you the three kings that reigned as the United Kingdom, and then of course it divides, and now you've got two nations, the nation of Judah and the nation of Israel. And so, because this week you started into, we started into the book of 1 Samuel, maybe this chart can help you. It helps me to keep my head straight as to what's going on when. And so you can help. And maybe this, for me, again, this is just one of those things that reminds me that we're talking about real people and real things, not just stories that we're reading in our old antiquated Bibles, maybe. But these are things that are real people. These are real events that happened in real time. And we can really say that Solomon reigned in about 1000 BC, and we know that. And those are things that are sure. And so maybe that will help you, and it will tell you which nations reign. So as you're reading through 1 and 2 Samuel over the next several weeks and into the kings, keep that handy, and it maybe help you keep track of what's going on. So tonight, where we're going to find ourselves is down toward the end of this, down toward, I believe it's down near the end of the green bar. It is. We're down near the end of the green bar in the middle, and it's going to be at the time in which Nebuchadnezzar, who was king of who? The king of the Babylon. The king of the Babylonians is the one who is responsible for coming to the city of Jerusalem and destroying, burning it to the ground, the city and taking God's people captive back to the nation of Babylon, back to Mesopotamia, and he takes his people and keeps them captive there for for about 70 years or so. What's sometimes called simply the Babylonian captivity, or sometimes it's called the second exile, in which they're taken away from their homeland and put somewhere else. That's where God's people were. So I want to, if you don't mind, let's read a few passages tonight to sort of get ourselves acquainted with what's going on here. And if you've been reading the book of Jeremiah and you read the book of Isaiah previously, we sort of know what's going on, because Jeremiah is going to tell us that story. But I want to start with one of our readings from this week, from the book of Habakkuk. If you don't mind, let's turn to the book of Habakkuk and do a little bit of reading and give ourselves a little bit of a background of what's of maybe the mind of God more so than the event. Let's look at what's causing all of this, all right? From the book of Habakkuk. Habakkuk is the prophet who is writing around 600 B.C. And so about maybe from 609 B.C. up until the city of Jerusalem is destroyed. Habakkuk is the prophet to the southern kingdom. He is one who is writing and is speaking in the nation of Judah, in the southern kingdom of Judah. And he's writing, sort of giving warnings to the people of what's going to happen. And the book of Habakkuk is set up at the beginning, at least, by two questions. Habakkuk has two questions, and his questions are not to people but to God. And so let's start in verse 1. If you've read this, it'll be a little review for you. But let's start Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 1. Let's see Habakkuk's question. He writes in verse 2, O Lord, how long shall I cry, and you will not hear? Even cry out to you, violence, and you will not save. Why do you show me iniquity and cause me to see trouble? For plundering and violence are before me. There is strife and contention arises. Therefore the law is powerless and justice never goes forth, for the wicked surround the righteous. Therefore perverse judgment proceeds. Now if Habakkuk is living in the Judah, what's the situation that Habakkuk describes here? Is it a good one? It's not good at all, right? Who's he talking about here? Is he talking about his enemies that are causing things to be terrible in Judah? Who's he talking about here, do you think? Talking about his own people, isn't he? He's crying out to God, saying, God, how long are you going to let these wicked people stand? Everywhere, everybody around me, all around me is just violence and plunder and awful things going on. And how can you let them stand and do all of this, God? And God's answer, if we're going to keep going, in verse 5, God answers, look, among the nations and watch, be utterly astonished, for I will work a work in your days which you would not believe though it were told you. I'm indeed raising up the Chaldeans, and the Chaldeans is just another name for the Babylonians. Chaldea is sort of another name for that nation. So I'm raising up the Chaldeans, a bitter and a hasty nation, which marches through the breadth of the earth to possess dwelling that are not theirs. They are terrible, they are dreadful, their judgment and their dignity proceed from themselves. Their horses also are swifter than leopards and more fierce than evening wolves. Their chargers charge ahead, their cavalry comes afar. They fly as the eagle that hastens to eat. They all come for violence. Their faces are set like the east wind. They gather captives like sand. They scoff at their kings, and princes are scorned by them. They deride every stronghold, for they heap up earthen mounds, and they seize it. And then his mind changes, and he transgresses. He commits offense, ascribing this power to his God. And so God's answer to Habakkuk is, don't worry, I'm going to take care of things, okay? Don't worry about your people. I know that they're wicked, and I'm going to take care of that. I'm going to bring people. I'm actually going to bring the Chaldeans, and I'm going to bring the Chaldeans in, and they are violent, and they are nasty, and they are terrible, and they are going to destroy everything that you know. Who's behind the destruction of the city of Jerusalem? Nebuchadnezzar's the one acting it out. Who's the one behind it? God is the one who is the orchestrator of all of this, which sort of makes some people scratch their head and say, how could God do such a thing, right? But this is the situation that's coming. Now, we won't continue on, but the prophet's second question, if you would keep reading, and we'll read that, I believe, tomorrow, his question to God is, the Chaldeans? They're worse than we are. How can you bring them against us? And it's sort of ironic that Habakkuk sees the reality that they are. They're worse than the Jews. How can you use a wicked nation to destroy a less wicked nation? But that's the way that God does.
He says, I'll take care of them later.
And that's right, and he does. And he'll, if you read in the book of Jeremiah, the last chapter of the book of Jeremiah, that very thing is said. Don't worry, I haven't forgot about the Babylonians. We'll take care of them as well. And he does, eventually, in time. And so we have Habakkuk chapter 1, where we find out that it is God's decision to punish the Jewish people, to punish his people by using the Babylonians. So that's number one. If you go to the book of, we don't have to read all of this because you all have just read it and Bill has talked about it. If you start in chapter 39 of the book of Jeremiah, we get a picture of who this Nebuchadnezzar is. And for those of you who maybe have not read it, I'd like to read for you just a short little section from the book of Jeremiah. In chapter 39 and verse 4, this is the actual fall of Jerusalem. This will give you a picture of who Nebuchadnezzar is and how nice of a guy he really is. Jeremiah chapter 39 and verse 4, we're told, it was when Zedekiah, the king of Judah, and all of the men of war saw them, saw the Babylonians, that they fled and they went out of the city by night and by the way of the king's garden, by the gate between the two walls, and he went out by the plain. But the Chaldean army pursued them, and he overtook King Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho. And when they'd captured him, they brought him up to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, to Riblah in the land of Hamath, and they pronounced judgment on him. And so they decided that Zedekiah has to pay for his rebellion against the Babylonians. And listen to Nebuchadnezzar does. The king of Babylon killed the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes in Riblah. The king of Babylon also killed all the nobles of Judah. Moreover, he then put out Zedekiah's eyes and bound him with bronze fetters to carry him off to Babylon. Now, this record is recorded in the book of 1 Kings as well. This will give you the picture of the atrocities of what kind of a guy King Nebuchadnezzar was. He takes Zedekiah out, he stands him in the plain, murders his two sons right in front of him, and then plucks his eyes out so that the last thing he ever saw on earth was the death of his sons. That's the kind of guy we're dealing with, okay? This is the kind of nation that's going on. So, God is going to use this wicked and awful man, as we can read in the book of Jeremiah. And then, 2 Kings chapter 24 and following is the record of Nebuchadnezzar. Beginning in about 606 BC, they come to Jerusalem the first time, and they sort of depose the king, and Nebuchadnezzar puts his own king in, and they take a whole bunch of people away, and they carry them away, among whom, do you remember who was in that first round of people that Nebuchadnezzar drags back to Babylon? Daniel, right? Daniel, and he comes again a second time, if memory's going to serve me right. I believe the second time, is it Ezekiel that goes the second time, or does he go with the first? If anybody remembers it. It's either the first or the second. I don't remember off the top of my head. But Ezekiel, the prophet Ezekiel, is also one of those that's grabbed and taken back to Babylon. He comes the first time in 606 and then goes home and then gets mad because the kings are rebelling. And he comes back a second time in 597 BC and does it again and drags a whole lot more people back. And finally, he gets so fed up with them, all of it, that he comes back in 586 BC and says, we've had enough. The book of Lamentations is written at the we've had enough point. Okay, this is what's going on when the book of Lamentations is written. The book of Isaiah records some of this. The book of Jeremiah is where we've just finished, in which he tells the story of Jerusalem being destroyed. The book of 2 Kings, the book of 2 Chronicles. All of these books give us the story. Ezekiel gives us a very, very detailed picture of what's going on, just like Jeremiah does. This is the awful picture that's happening in all of this. And so this is just going to tell you this is what's going to happen. Yes, Mr. Jim.
This is a good example of how God works his providence. And both those who are not his people and those who are his people. Now, with choose. They chose to be very, very evil. And I said, all right, you go, you've chosen this way, and I'm still going to use you to bring my judgment upon Judah because of their evil way. And so he didn't interfere with their freedom to choose, Judah, nor the Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the way you're going to choose.
It's a very good, very, very good point to make in all of this is that, we don't want to leave it that God is using his puppet strings to drag Nebuchadnezzar around to do all of these things. These are people just like it was way back when Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, was the same way in which God used him to accomplish his purpose with his people. He uses the king Sennacherib, the king of the Assyrians, in 722. He uses that nation to come and destroy the northern kingdom of Israel. And now he's going to use these other people. All of these people are wicked, regardless of what God is doing. These people are wicked by their own choice. And it shows the unbelievable wisdom and providence of God to be able to use people in their own actions to accomplish what he wants done. And this is one of those places and it's a good thing to point out at this point. Thank you, Jim. So let's move on to the book, okay? Let's move on to Lamentations to get started and find out what is going to go on and find out what Jeremiah has to say as a result of the end of all of this. The city has either been destroyed or is in the process of being destroyed. We don't know for sure, but this is the situation. This is going to give us the really pretty picture, terrible picture from chapter 1 of what's going on. I'm just going to put 5 chapters on the left on the screen. There's nothing detailed in front of you. Just going to give you a little what's going on in each chapter, and then we'll just read a few verses till we get to chapter 3. Chapter 1, we'll just simply call it a city suffering, and this is where Jeremiah sits back and he personifies the city as a woman, and he begins to describe her suffering and her pain of how things are going on. And I hesitate to, you know, because it's painful to read and because it's really difficult to read, you know, it's tempting to just say, well, we know what's going on, but I want to read it tonight because I want to read it together, and sometimes it's beneficial to me to hear it read aloud to really get the force of what's going on. We're not going to read the whole thing, but I want to just pull out a few passages, and I want us to really see how terrible things were so that we can see how great things become in the end. Look in the first verse. Let's just start in Lamentations chapter 1. Jeremiah very simply says, "How lonely sits the city that was full of people. How like a widow is she who was great among the princes among the provinces, has become a slave. She weeps bitterly in the night. Her tears are on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, she has none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They have all become her enemies. Judah has gone into captivity under affliction and hard servitude. She dwells among the nations. She finds no rest. All her persecutors overtake her in dire straits. The roads to Zion mourn because no one comes to set the feasts. All her gates are desolate. Her priests sigh. Her virgins are afflicted, and she is in bitterness. Her adversaries have become the master. Her enemies prosper. For the Lord has afflicted her because of the multitude of her transgressions. Her children have gone into captivity before the enemy." We can stop right there for that portion. I should make mention of it as well. If you have, depending on what version of your Bible, I use a New King James Version, and it sets the text off sort of where it's written sort of like the Psalms. Whenever you see a text set off like this, it means that this is written in poetry. And so the Book of Lamentation is a giant poem. It's actually made up of 5 different poems. Every chapter, except for chapter 3, has 22 verses. There are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, and so each verse of each chapter begins with a letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So, you know, in our language, we would say verse 1 starts with A, verse 2 starts with B, verse 2 starts with C. That's the way Lamentations is written. Chapter 3 is written in which there are triplets, and so the first 3 verses start with A, the second 3 verses start with B, and that's the way it's written. And so this is one large poem to talk about the destruction of what's going on. He calls her, just the first verse in and of itself, "How lonely sits the city. It was full of people, and now it's desolate. Now there's nobody." Just to take all of the splendor, all of the enormous beauty, and literally burn it to the ground. And take all of the gold that was beautiful and carry it away. And take all of the people so that all that are left are slaves and peasants and poor and sick people who've been left to lay in the street. That's the situation of what's going on. Look down in verse 8. Give us a little reason as to what's going on. "Jerusalem has sinned gravely, therefore she has become vile, and all who honored her despise her because they have seen her nakedness. Yes, she sighs and she turns away." Go down to verse 11. "All her people sigh. They seek bread. They've given their valuables for food to restore life. See, O Lord, and consider. I am scorned," she says. "Is it nothing to you, all you who pass by? Behold and see if there's any sorrow like my sorrow, which has been brought on me, which the Lord has inflicted in the day of his fierce anger. From above he has sent fire into my bones, and it overpowered them. He spread a net for my feet. He's turned me back. He's made me desolate and faint. All the day the yoke of my transgressions was bound. They were woven together by his hands and thrust upon my neck. He made my strength to fail. The Lord delivered me into the hands of those whom I am not able to withstand." Go down to verse 19. "I called for my lovers, but they have deceived me. My priests and my elders, they have breathed their last in this city while they sought for food to restore their life. Lord, I am in distress. My soul is troubled. My heart is overturned within me. I've been very rebellious. Outside, the sword bereaves. At home, it is like death." This is the situation. It's heartbreaking to read. It's terrible to have to read Jeremiah in the midst of it. And I picture Jeremiah in the midst of what's going on writing these. Maybe it's an afterthought. I don't know. Maybe he's sitting and just witnessing constant death. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people either dying from disease because the Babylonians have surrounded the city and cut off all water and food. And so they're either starving or they've had some sort of a disease, or they've, if you read from the book, from the Old Testament in the book of Deuteronomy, one of the prophecies was that, and it's probably familiar to you, that things will be so bad that the mother will be forced to eat the child, okay, to maybe be able to survive. This is the fulfillment of that, Deuteronomy chapters 28 and 29. This is what's happening as a result from all of those years ago when God said, "I know the time is coming when you won't listen, and it's going to happen, and it's going to come." This is the awful time of what's going on. And so the picture that Jeremiah paints, again, is not a good one. Chapter 2, he moves on, and again, to remind us of the fact, and we won't read a lot of chapter 2, but just for reminiscence sake, go back to the book of Habakkuk, where we just read when Habakkuk asked the question, "How long are you going to let these people live?" And God says, "Don't worry, I'm going to take care of that. The Chaldeans are coming, Babylonians are coming." Chapter 2 is reminiscent of to me, the book of Job. Do you remember when you read the book of Job, we sometimes get the picture when we know Job as the great man of patience, right? And oftentimes our picture of patience is the kind and gentle old man who just never raises his voice and just sits quietly and takes it all. Is that the picture of Job that you got when you read the book of Job? Not in any way, shape, or form, right? No way. Job says things to God that makes me shudder, right? That if we read it and we would think, he just said that to God. Because Job just lashes out and he begins to say, "This is your fault. You are doing this to me. I don't deserve this. How could you treat me this way?" And he lashes out at God. And chapter 2 of Lamentations sort of reminds me of that. This time, however, God is justified in the book of Job as well, but this time the people deserve what they're getting. And God has told them that over and over and over again. And so Jeremiah just simply begins to say, he just lays it on God and says that this is the Lord has swallowed up in verse 2, and he has not had pity on us. All the dwelling places of Jacob, he's thrown down in his wrath. The strongholds of the daughter of Judah, he's brought them down to the ground. He has profaned the kingdom and his princes. Go down to to verse 5. The Lord was like an enemy, he says. The Lord is our enemy. Can you believe that? He says to God, you're like our enemy. You've swallowed up Israel. He swallowed up all her palaces. He's destroyed her strongholds and has increased mourning and lamentation in the daughter of Judah. He's done violence in his tabernacle as if it were a garden. He's destroyed the place of assembly. The Lord has caused the appointed feasts and Sabbaths and to be forgotten in Zion. And in his burning indignation, he has spurned the king and the priest. He's laying it all on God and saying, you're tearing up your temple. You're destroying your holy place. The priests, you've just defiled them all. He goes on and talk in verse 7 that the Lord has spurned his altar. He's abandoned his sanctuary. He's given up the walls of her palaces into the hand of the enemy. They've made a noise in the house as the Lord. And it goes on and on and on and on and on and on. This, the picture, and when we read the book of Ezekiel, you'll see this is sort of, Ezekiel paints the very detailed picture of it as well, in which at one point the Lord goes down and Ezekiel is told to look into the temple at what's going on, and he sees the atrocities that are happening inside the temple in Jerusalem. And there's a terrible picture of God resting at the corner of the temple. And Ezekiel says, the Spirit of the Lord turned and it left. Never to return. He just paints the picture of how God, who had dwelt in this place for so long, is now time to leave. He's had enough, and it's gone. And that's the picture that we get. So this is the awfulness. This is what's happening. This is the picture that we have. My eyes, verse 11, fail with tears. My heart is troubled. My bile is poured out on the ground because of the destruction of the daughter of my people, because the children of the infants faint in the streets. It's a terrible picture. Now, we had to read all of that, okay? We had to do it because it helps us to realize, Khalil Gibran said that sometimes for the heart to be carved out with sorrow only means more joy that it can contain. And this is sort of one of those situations where the picture is terrible to help us to realize how good it is. Yes, Jim? You're fine?
I have one afterthought. God gets through using the Babylonians or Chaldeans to bring his judgment. He will bring judgment against these Chaldeans and Babylonians, not because of what they did to you, because they've always chosen to be very evil.
Mm-hmm.
And so he uses another nation to bring judgment upon the Babylonians or Chaldeans, and that nation is Persia. And after a while, he uses another nation bring his judgment on Persia, and that's the Greeks.
And then after that, the Romans to take judgment on the Greeks, and then after that, the Romans again to take judgment on the Jews, and after that, God is always working with his people. And those are good things to point out, that God is not just endorsing all that. He's not giving, you know, Nebuchadnezzar the Passover here and just saying, oh, it's fine, whatever you want to do. He takes care of them in eventually as well. And so those are good things to remember. Let's do chapter 3 really quickly, because we've got 10 minutes. Chapter 3 is sort of that moment where Jeremiah comes to grips with the situation and where he sees how awful it is. He realizes that it just can't get any worse. He lashes out at God for what God is doing to his own holy place. And in chapter 3 is the place where he sort of comes to grip. And the first part of chapter 3, we won't read it for time, but he goes on and he talks about how bad things are still personal now. Right, the first two chapters have been what the city's going through and how things are happening. Chapter 3, he goes to the first person pronoun, I am the man who has seen affliction by the rod of his wrath, verse 1. So now we're talking personal. This is Jeremiah's own journal. And he goes on and talks about all, again, the stuff that he has gone through. And then I'd like for you to go over to verse 19. Verse 18, he says, I said, my strength and my hope, they have perished from the Lord. And verse 19, remember my affliction and my roaming, the wormwood and the gall. My soul still remembers within me, and it still stinks, or excuse me, and it sinks within me. This I recall to mind. And then the change of tone in verse 21 at the end. Therefore, I have hope. It's an abrupt transition, right, for somebody to say, look at this awful picture. Look at how terrible things are. And now I have to see it. and my own bones are weak, and my own flesh is beaten, and I feel as though my hope is gone, or my strength and my hope, verse 18, they perish from the Lord. I don't understand. I'm remembering all of my affliction and all of the things that have gone over me, and yet he says, verse 21, but my soul still remembers. I still remember maybe the way things used to be, or maybe the way things or the things that God used to do, or the relationship that God and I used to have. And he said, I still remember that. And he said, because I remember that, I have hope. And from this point on is the record of his change of heart, coming to grips with it. Let's pull out just a few verses that I know you've read, but let's pull out a few things. The first one that we sang just a few minutes ago, verse 22. If you read him from a New International Version, I don't know what the English Standard Version says, but the steadfast love of the Lord, it never ceases. His mercies never come to an end, for they are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. Right? The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I will hope in him. Some of versions, my version says that though the Lord's mercy, through the Lord's mercies, we're not consumed. It's only because of his mercy that we haven't suffered more. Now, that's a positive spin, if I've ever heard one, isn't it? To see the terrible things that are going on, to see all of the death and destruction, and for Jeremiah to say, you know what? It's only because of God's mercy that we didn't suffer more. You know, in other words, it could have been worse. it blows your mind to see somebody in the presence of death and destruction to say, you know, God's made sure it wasn't worse than what it really was. It's through his mercies that we're not consumed. In fact, he says his mercies are never ending. In fact, he says every morning I can wake up in the presence of death and destruction and pain and dying. He said his mercies are there every time I wake up. They are new, and not just blessings. His mercies are new. His compassions are new every single morning. And then he stops and makes the simple confession. You are faithful. Great is your faithfulness to us, God. And in the presence of all of this, that's his confession. He goes on to say, verse 24, the Lord is my portion, says my soul. In other words, you know, what else do I need? I don't need anything. The Lord has filled me completely. I don't need anything more. The Lord, therefore, because of all of that, he says, I will have hope in him. It's reminiscent of the psalm, and that was quoted again in the book of Hebrews, chapter 13, in which the psalmist says, what can man do to me, right? I will put my trust in the Lord. What's man going to do to me? Because I have the Lord is on my side. He goes on in verses 25 and following. We're not going to be able to do it all. Verse 25, he simply says, and this is sort of the coming to grips of it all. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the soul who seeks after him. It's good that one should hope and to wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. Verse 28, let him sit alone and keep silent, because God has laid this upon him. This is the man in suffering who says, you know what, it's actually a good thing that we're going through this. It's actually good for me to learn to wait, because I want deliverance now, but what the Lord wants me to do is wait on that. And I want salvation from this suffering and pain now, but it's actually, he said, it's good. The Lord is good to those who wait. And he said, it is good that one should hope, and then to wait quietly. It reminds me of Psalm 27, my favorite of the Psalms, in which David says that I would have lost heart. Right? He said, everybody's turned against me, my mother, my father. The enemies are surrounding me. Things are terrible. My enemies are lashing out in false witness, and I would have lost hope, he says. But I remembered, or I knew, that I would see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. And so he says, wait on the Lord and be of good courage. He'll strengthen your heart. Wait, I say, on the Lord. That's David's conclusion, in the same that Jeremiah says, it's good for me to stop in the midst of all this terrible stuff and remember that what God really wants me to do is just be willing to wait on him and trust that he's going to lead us through. He goes on down and at the end of verse 37. In verse 37, he talks about, he asks the question, who is he who speaks and it comes to pass when the Lord has not commanded it? Is it not from the mouth of the Most High that woe and well-being proceed? In other words, who's going to talk and make something happen if the Lord is not, if it's not the Lord's will for it to happen? And it's exalting the fact that the Lord is in control above all. And then he asks the question, verse 39, why should a living man complain a man for the punishment of his sins? In other words, Jeremiah says, you know what, we've deserved it. We've deserved what we have got because we've sinned in this way. We've suffered terribly, and it's awful, and we have no right to complain for it because this is what we deserve. But yet in all of it, he says, I know that his steadfast love endures forever, and it never is going to cease. Their mercies are new every morning because he is faithful. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I hope in him. I hope that maybe just a few things for you to think about, and you can go on both of the end of these the last two chapters, he goes back to sort of tough things to read again. Chapter 4 tells us sort of the cost of all of this, of how many people have to suffer as a result of it. And then chapter 5 is the prayer to God, sort of them saying, we'd really like you to relent. We'd really like your deliverance now. And he concludes the book. You, O Lord, verse 19, chapter 5, remain forever. Your throne from generation to generation. Why do you forget us forever and forsake us for so long a time? Turn us back to you, O Lord, and we will be restored. Renew our days as of old, unless you have utterly rejected us and you are angry with us. That's the end of their prayer. Turn us back to you if you're willing. If you haven't rejected us, we'd love to come back. And that's the end of the book and the prayer. Not easy reading. It's hard, but it's something good for us to think about. Let's, because of our time, let's go ahead and we'll close with the prayer, and then we'll go our way. God, we are so honored that we can call you our God. We are so grateful, Father, that you let us be together, that you let us have these relationships to share. We're thankful, God, that just as Jeremiah, even in the depths of our despair, in the times of troubles that we all endure, we're thankful, God, that in all of it we can have hope in you, because we know that you don't leave us. We know that you never forsake us. We know that no man can do harm to our soul. God, we pray that you would help us in our everyday lives to take inspiration from Jeremiah, from men like Jeremiah and all of those prophets who stood firm in the midst of terrible days, and yet we're able to declare, Father, how great your faithfulness is to us. May we ever remember what you do for us. May we ever remember who you are and what you provide us. And as a result of that, Father, may we take hope and have hope and faith in you. Bless us, Father, to faithfulness to you, to walk in the ways of your Son, and to be the kind of people that we should be, to shine the light of the gospel, to shine the light of what it means to live a joyful and peaceful life in you. Thank you for that privilege. Help us to be the people we should be as we leave until we're back together again on the Lord's Day. Bless us, Father, in all that we do. We extend to you our love and our praise and adoration for all that you are. In the name of Jesus, amen. Thank you all very much.